Okay, hey,
Love
listen.
Talk Radio.
All right, now we start. Okay, hey, everybody. It is Tuesday, April 2nd, and you are listening to, or even better, downloading, my podcast, which the new title of which will stick, is Richard Kramer, : These Things Happen, which is a very subtle reference to my book of the same name, which is available at your better bookstores and your worst bookstores, and on Kindle, too, which is where everybody wants it, which is the name of Tevye's gay granddaughter, who left Anatevka and became a contractor in America. So that's Kindle and Associates. And so whenever I can remember to do this, and I'm remembering more and more, I have guests on the show who interest me and I hope will interest you too. These are people who have made these things happen out there in the world themselves, which is the last time I will awkwardly wedge in the title of my book. Because my guest today, who I'm thrilled to have here, has a book of his own. His name is Tim Federle. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about his book, Better Nate Than Ever, which only the literal-minded would describe as being for young readers. I would describe it as being for all readers. But the book, Better Nate Than Ever, however you want to describe it, is about different kinds of flight. And I will say what I mean by that. I get this page down here, which is the flight, its title character, the undersized 13-year-old Nate Foster, makes from misery in his hometown of horrible Jankburg, which is a great name, Pennsylvania, it's a perfect name, to a Broadway audition for a musical version of E.T., which you know, thinking about it, I think is something that somebody should actually do because it would be kind of amazing. And it's about another kind of flight, too, which is that of the imagination that lifts this kid up beyond the range of the stupid guns that are pointed at him by the bullies in his school who think they know who he is and want to force him to accept that knowledge. And it's also, I think, most importantly, a book about the flight that we all make on the way to becoming. It's about this boy whose wings in that flight are still powered by innocence. He isn't yet all the things he's going to be, but he's going to be there soon. The novel picks Nate Foster up and puts him down on a road where he can see the towers of Emerald City start to gleam, just for him, welcoming him. And maybe someday, if he's really lucky, he'll even get to see Wicked, and I can help him get house seats for that, because I know the person who wrote it, who is, incidentally, for all those who will be coming back, my guest on the next on this next podcast next week.
Wow. I'm like the yes. TV performer.
Please, please tune in, Tim Federle, for Winnie Holton. And so I want to say, you know, just about Tim's book, which is Better Nate Than Ever, which is also a really wonderful title. It delighted me, made me laugh out loud, it touched me, and it made me want to write a book exactly like it, which is the highest compliment I know how to pay to a book. And unfortunately, Tim Federle has already done that. He is, on top of being a wonderful debut novelist, a performer on Broadway, too. I have never heard him sing, but I've heard him write.
That's
I hope
like
to hear
threat.
Him sing sometime.
Yeah,
but I've
like
heard him write.
Anything can happen.
Exactly. And you might even want to sing during this podcast. And his is one of the freshest voices that I have come across in a long time. It is innocent and experienced at the same moment. It is winning and sweet, but not without its own original hints of darkness, which is one of the things I found most interesting about it. The book is written for young readers, as I said earlier, but this ancient reader liked it so much he read it twice with gratitude and envy. So Tim Federle, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations.
Thank you, Jerry.
Oh, Jerry,
do you have a cold?
I always have a cold. And congratulations, as she says, welcome to Fresh Air. And and I want to congratulate you on the publication of your book, which is Simon & Schuster has just put out in its Books for Young Readers division. So that leads me to, first of all, how are you today, Tim?
I'm so happy. I feel like I'm attending my own memorial. You just gave
them a beautiful
speech.
That's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah, no, that was really so lovely, Richard. And I hope your listeners also know that These Things Happen is a fantastic and a beautiful book as well, though it just sounds like I'm saying that because I'm on your podcast. And admittedly,
because I asked you to.
You know, Yeah, no, but it's beautiful. It's beautiful, and it's getting so much incredible. You know, I hate the word buzz. God, do I hate the word buzz?
But I hate it too. I hate it too.
It's a beautiful book, and I'm and you know that because you wrote it. But I hope your listeners know that too.
Thank you very much. Well, we will wedge in many remarks about my beautiful book, but we will really try to talk to you. Are you on tour right now? Are you on book tour?
I am not, but I am. If my book tour were an Oreo, I am right now the cream filling, and I'm back in my adopted hometown of New York City. But I went on a book tour that took me back to Pittsburgh, where I grew up, and a bunch of other cities, including Tampa, where I did not grow up. And now I'm back in New York for a little breather, and then next week I go back out, and I go to Wisconsin and Chicago and a bunch of places.
Well, we could talk about book tour at some point, but let's talk first of all about your book, which is the first thing that occurred to me when I was reading it is I flashed back to, I wanted to know when you were a young reader, which I assume you were, because there's a
yeah.
real love of the word in this book.
Mm-hmm.
When you were a young reader, what books did you particularly love?
Great question. I mean,
thank you.
I was, yeah, thank you. And
I wanted to spring
a
surprise
on
you.
I loved anything by Roald Dahl. Actually.
Oh my God!
And you know, Matilda is now in previews on Broadway, and I just thought that Roald Dahl had such a sensational grasp of the fact that not every child and not every adult on Earth is you know, kind-hearted. And so I sort of loved that because in reading his books as a young person, I was able to see he had such a point of view that felt so unedited. So I loved Roald Dahl, and I loved Shel Silverstein for sort of the same reason. There was a real darkness that that I loved that teachers trusted in these writers, and they really allowed their students to discover that.
Well, you know, that's Roald Dahl is a very interesting person to refer to because I can see and feel the influence of Roald Dahl in sort of the Better Nate Than Ever. There's a kind of a secret elegance to your style that never calls attention to itself, but when you read a page twice, you see that there is real artfulness at work. And I think that's certainly
Thank
the case
you.
With him. Well, you offered the comparison, but I agree with it totally. Interestingly, perhaps to nobody but me, Roald Dahl, when I was a kid, had not written the books yet. And what
uh-huh.
he was famous for was as being the husband of the great actress Patricia Neal, who do you even know who that is? Sure, you know. Who
I do. No, I do. But I had actually forgotten this sort of Snapple fun fact live and on the air. I had forgotten that they were married.
They were not only married. When they were married, she had a terrible.
They were not
stroke.
Only married. They're here today.
They're here with me today
yeah,
in the
yeah,
other
yeah.
room. Just wait, just having
yeah.
tea. But she had a famously terrible stroke, and they thought she was going to die, and. And he nursed her back to health. So he was a figure of great sort of, you know, husbandly kindness who was later exposed to be an absolute monster. But,
yeah, totally.
But, but she wrote a terrible book about him. But there was a TV movie about Roald Dahl and Patricia Neal that starred Dirk Bogarde and Glenda Jackson.
Mm.
And so the books came later, so, you know, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Matilda and the BFG and all that stuff were not, unfortunately, around in my childhood. But have you seen Matilda? Tell me that.
I haven't seen it in New York, so I need to. It's a hot ticket. Everyone's talking about it.
There was
I've
a
heard
really,
great things. I've got some
so
friends from my Billy Elliot days, who are in the production, so I need to go, you know, check it out. It's supposed to be just totally fantastic and dark and English and all those things that I love.
There was we're going to talk about your Billy Elliot days, which I think are fantastic. But there was a really good article for readers out there in the New Yorker last week by
and Michael Schulman.
Michael Schulman. about Tim Minchin, who I had never heard of, who has apparently written a wonderful and funny and sort of acid score for Matilda.
Well, and there was something in there that I thought was so cool, Richard, which was, I guess Tim is Australian, and I think he's 37 now, and he and his wife are quoted in this article in the New Yorker, and he talks about how when he was 31, 32 years old, he felt like he couldn't even get arrested. And now all of a sudden he's got this kind of, and you know, all of a sudden it's like the phrase overnight sensation, which never really happens. But he, you know, worked his tail off all these years, and now it sounds as if he's just inundated with all the types of projects we all dream of. And it really struck me, because I think one of the things on this kind of book tour you were talking about, one of the things I've noticed when I meet these kids and talk to all these kids about my book is they have a hard time wrapping their heads around the concept that even grown-ups, maybe especially grown-ups, don't always know what they want to be when they grow up. And so I think it's so interesting to read about somebody like this guy who wrote Matilda for the stage, who is still kind of discovering his voice and who he is and finding a wide audience. And, of course, I'm totally fascinated, Richard, in your kind of transition from this outrageous television career into this incredibly accomplished novel. I'm always inspired by people who kind of wear multiple hats.
Oh, well, you know, this was a hat that I found. We'll stick with the subject of me just for a second here, that I really found very late in life. You know, I mean, I'm not dead, but I,
exactly.
I mean, it wasn't something that happened at my graveside, but mm-hmm. I had always wanted to write a book. I started out as a fiction writer. I was the third youngest person to ever be published in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And then I wound up coming to L.A. by a series of strange coincidences that, you know, sort of are the mm-hmm. story of everybody's life. And I then, at 57, you know, decided, if I don't write a book now, I'm just going to be fundamentally pissed off at myself. And
mm-hmm.
the time was right. You know, this. I think that you know, one corollary to what you're saying, Tim, is that, you know, there's a I wrote about this someplace. When I was in college, I had a very, very intense, devastating affair that lasted for years with my roommate.
Wow.
And that was both incredibly exciting and incredibly devastating. And I couldn't do my work one year. And I had this class, which was a Shakespeare class, and I just couldn't get the paper written. And I wrote the teacher a very long letter and explaining everything. And she said, please come see me. So I did. And this woman was one of the leading Shakespeare scholars in the world, so she could quote anything.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, Mr. Kramer, she said, thank you so much for your very personal and moving letter. I'd like to quote King Lear to you. And I said, yeah, sure, go ahead, whatever. And she said, there's a line in Lear where they say, a life takes its own time and ripeness is all. And I thought, wow, that's beautiful. And she said, I'm still going to fail you, but I want you to remember that.
Oh, my God. And that woman was Patricia Neal.
She was Patricia Neal.
That is so funny.
That's good listening. That's good listening.
No, that's just so funny that she failed you, but she left you that devastating
She
quote.
Did. And what so, a... yeah. And I am, you know, like, you know, complete proof of, you know, that when the fruit is ripe, the fruit falls from the tree. So I fell from the tree.
Yeah.
And thank God.
And you landed on your feet. You landed on your feet.
Basically, yeah. So back to you, Tim Federle, and Better Nate Than Ever, just published. In terms of reading now, are you a big reader now? And what books and writers, you know, do you feel passionate about?
I am a big reader. I think you sort of have to be, I guess. Though
I think you do, too.
Yeah, I mean, The best book, I read a lot of books on writing a couple of years ago, because I think, like you, Richard, I had a moment where I said, okay, if I don't write this now, I'm going to regret it. And so I read a ton of, I mean, basically everything except for How to Get a Novel Published, you know, The Idiot's Guide. And Stephen King's book on writing, called On Writing, was, I thought, the absolute best sort of primer for the career. It just was so smart. You know, he basically said, cut all of your adverbs and get to work and read a lot. So I read a lot of nonfiction, actually, because I'm just really inspired by real stories. Most recently, the book that touched me the deepest and I read the fastest and then reread was a book called Tiny Beautiful Things by Cheryl Strayed, who has
Oh, is that her newspaper column?
Yeah, exactly, from the Rumpus. And then it's kind of like Dear Abby for our century, and it's so smart and it's so acidic, and I was really touched by it. I thought it was, you know, people write to her anonymously originally. People wrote to her at this website, and then she answered their letters, and so it's kind of a compilation of those letters. I love her, and, oh, gosh, who else am I reading fiction-wise? I have to think about that. I love Cheryl. And Jonathan Mayberry is a novelist for young people who's got a zombie series out, which just totally tickles me. I'm not usually into, you know, dystopian or fantasy of any kind, but it's kind of a zombie series with heart, oxymoronically enough. So that series kind of tickled me. So yeah, I try to, and I also, you know, like you, I read The New Yorker, and I try to kind of keep one toe in the world of what's really happening. Because as a writer on these deadlines, it's so easy just to live in a world of mixed nuts and Coke straight from the bottle and sweatpants, and you go like, oh, that's right, is there a real world actually happening out there? So
it's hard to remember that, but these are I love these answers. First of all, I just want to say that we will have links. They always say this on the Slate podcast, so I'm just going to imitate that.
Oh,
no, I don't know how to do it. There will be links to on our show page, if I even have one, the Cheryl Strayed book, to the Stephen King book, which is called On Writing, which is a book that I love also, and so it is a fantastic, you know, primer or primer for you if you are just starting or even if you're finishing in your life. It just brings all basic principles into focus. And Jonathan Mayberry and his Vampire with Heart series. So the those are excellent answers. I'm going to give you, I'm going to pass you, unlike the teacher who failed me.
Thank you. No King Lear for me.
And then, all right, I did a tiny bit of research, which really involved going onto Wikipedia and reading a couple of interviews with you. But you grew up, you were born in California, but
yeah,
you grew up in Upper St. Clair, Pennsylvania, which is, from what I gathered, not as nice as Lower St. Clair, Pennsylvania, and I assume is the model for Jankberg. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's Upper St. Clair, Pennsylvania, as I will explain in a minute, turns out to have an interesting literary history. But do you have anything you want to say about Upper or Lower St. Clair?
Yeah, you're right, Upper St. Clair. So Upper St. Clair, it's a bit of a model in terms of my experience there was a bit like Nate Foster in Better Nate Than Ever, because I did not fit in. I was not a jock. I was not a particularly good student, actually. And those were the two things you had to be to get noticed in that school. I would say my fictional town of Jankberg, Pennsylvania, is a little more working class. It's a little on the other side of the tracks. And you know, Nate goes to the type of school that doesn't have a drama department, and all he wants to do is get to New York and dance on Broadway, or perform on Broadway, which was also my dream when I was 13. But yes, Upper St. Clair does have an interesting literary history. You're right.
We will get to that in 1 second, but I want, you know, I assume that there was an autobiographical element to Better Nate Than Ever, which you have just underlined, but what's also, this goes back to the earlier question about, you know, books and writers that you like now, which is that, you know, one thinks, you know, reading the first 10 pages of your book that it is going to go in predictable, heartwarming places. And
mm-hmm.
it doesn't. It doesn't mean that it's not satisfying, and it doesn't mean that it's not moving, and it doesn't mean that it's not, in some fundamental way, a story of a success. But it does not follow a template of feel-goodness, of empowerment. It's very unique, and the voice of it is very unique, and that's, I think, a real success on your part, that you were able to find in one of these unhappy kid finds escape narratives something that was quite specific and original to this story and to your voice as a writer. I just really want to, I know how hard that is to do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Richard. I know you found the same with Wesley and Theo in These Things Happen. I mean, you've got a background that speaks for itself with the sort of teenage characters that are associated with you. But one of the things I think I've tried to pick up on when I work with teenagers and kids, like in musical theater settings, is that they are, especially like tweens, which is another term that makes my skin crawl, but like those kids who are so wise and they get every joke, but they don't quite have total control over themselves yet. And it's just such a fascinating and hilarious age. And so I wanted to sort of capture some of that torment that Nate has and that so many kids who are 13 have. When you feel like you've got real opinions and you really know stuff about the world, but nobody will take you seriously, which is just awkward.
You have such empathy for this kid. And, you know, I found on YouTube, did you do these videos for, is it Playbill.com or for Broadway World? Or Broadway?
Oh,
were you
I did.
To the kids?
I did it for Playbill. Yeah, I did it for Playbill.com. Mm-hmm.
I would point, I'm going to put that on the show page too, because Tim talks to young performers on Broadway. I mean, really young, like the girl who's playing Annie in the James Lapine revival right now. She's delightful.
Yeah,
some kids from Billy Elliot. And the way you talk to them, my sense was that you, in a way, are them.
Except they're more talented and they got there faster. I mean, it's so funny to work with. It's like you work with kids these days. The kids these days, they're so advanced. I mean, I was walking to Whole Foods yesterday just to really underline that I'm white. And I saw this like 1-year-old in his stroller playing with an iPad, and I think I actually turned to my boyfriend. Spoiler alert: I'm gay, and I said something like, "Oh my gosh, like a 1-year-old with an iPad. What's next? You know, what's next is I get a gray hair. Is what's next? But it's kids. They're so precocious and hilarious. And yeah, this series that I did for Playbill, where I got to interview these Broadway kids. You're absolutely right, Richard. I feel like I didn't go to college. When I left Pittsburgh as a teenager and came to New York, I started dancing right away. And so there's a part of me that never quite feels like I grew up. And I still really, some of those rites of passages that I think a lot of people went through in college, stuff I actually never went through. And so in a way, I feel forever 18, which sort of gets me into trouble.
Well, you know, that underlines another thing that I think is compelling about your book. I have a new sort of theory about art, with a capital A, but also, you know, about books and movies. And that I like to read and see things that I feel that the author or director or whatever had to write, or they would not have been able to go on living.
Uh-huh.
And I felt that with Nate. I mean, that you know, and I can't be more articulate about it than that. But that's the dividing line for me right now, because there's plenty of fun stuff out there that I feel anybody could have done. But there's does that resonate for you?
It does. I mean, and frankly, on one hand, it's a pragmatic thing. I mean, early on, when I decided I wanted to write a book, I had a conversation with this person in publishing, and they said, "Well, you know, you have to write a Broadway book because it's the only thing. It's the book you have to write," which is sort of like prescriptive and dramatic. But there's something to it from the standpoint of, really being able to talk about it with, you know, passion and heart, but also experience, like saying that this is really what happens behind closed doors at a Broadway audition. And that was another thing I wanted to explore with the book, which is, you know, what happens when kids put themselves on the line for a big splashy Broadway show where none of the adults really know what they're doing, because, you know, that's one of the things you learn is that everyone's just making it up as they go along, no matter how old they are.
Yeah, that's totally true. But, you know, that brings to mind that one could describe this as a and this is not meant glibly, because this is actually meant incisively as I don't want to say the word tween, but as Chorus Line Junior.
Oh, no, I'll take that any day.
And, you know, the authenticity that I sensed of what goes on in that room, and viewed from the very interesting perspective of someone who has never seen it before,
mm-hmm.
which is Nate. I mean, it's all being revealed to him. It felt completely real to me. So I knew that I was in good hands, and I knew you knew what you were talking about. But the most important thing that you know what you were talking about is this boy. Without which, you know, there would be no book, and there's very much a book. I just wanted to quickly ask you, what
yeah.
made you sense when you were back in Upper St. Clair that you were different, that you were special, you know, which are often the same thing? How early did you have that inkling?
I think it was when I was about 10. You know, I felt different when people started looking at me differently, more than I felt different because it was some internal compass. And it was because, you know, I was really into theater, and I was not, you know, attached to some of the local football was a big thing in the town, and not a ton of people moved to Pittsburgh. So I was one of the only kids who wasn't a native. And so I remember just kind of like, I didn't go along with it. It wasn't my thing. But for a lot of kids, even kids like me, in quotes, if you grew up in Pittsburgh, I have a feeling you would have just, you know, gone along with it and gone to the football game and all of that. But it didn't feel native to me. So I think I felt different because I was willing to be different.
Well, that was in ways, I'm sure, difficult, and in ways a real blessing for you.
Yeah, and it was a blessing to have parents who stood, you know, beside me and paid for my dance classes.
Now, do you have, or did you have a not necessarily nice older brother, as Nate does in the book?
I have a great older brother, but he is older, and he was a star student, and he, you know, didn't, I think, totally get me. I remember in high school, he would come into my room when I was listening to Into the Woods and be like, "How do you listen to this terrible music? It's ridiculous." So, you know, I disowned him for several years, but we're totally cool now. You know, we've got that thing where we're grown-ups now and we can appreciate each other.
Now, see, if somebody had asked me that about Into the Woods, I would have just said, "But listen to the internal rhymes."
Exactly. You dolt, you caveman.
You fool. Now, here's one thing that's coming up. It is now 12:28, and Rachel, but it doesn't mean we can't keep going. I want to see if my producer is there. Tyson, are you there? You are. I think he's there.
He's left the industry. He's so disappointed. He's
had it with me.
The recording industry, yeah.
He's had it with me in my bottomless self-aggrandizement. Rachel Shuchard was my guest for three episodes in a row because we had a lot to say.
Yeah,
she and I went a whole hour.
Wow.
So I think it's safe for us to keep going, you know, for a reasonable amount of time, because I'm having too good a time and I don't want to cut this off at the 12:30 mark.
I love this. I might get kicked out of this very quiet space, this rare quiet New York City space. So this is like a real live unscripted radio show where at any moment someone could knock on the door. Yeah,
it is. And my dogs are sitting outside the closed door and they're just thinking, what the fuck is he doing in there?
Yeah, he hasn't looked as sad since, you know, Golden Girls went off the air.
But so let's just keep talking, and if we get cut off, you know, if it ends, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say, everybody, thanks for listening. Part two with Tim Federle will occur when it, you know, when we both feel like it. But let's keep talking, because the Rachel thing did go all the way to 55 minutes. So let's just keep talking.
Wow. let's just keep going.
And I have no sponsors other than myself, so we don't have to do anything like, you know, for Audible.com or Stamps, you know, Inc. or whatever it's called. So, all right, Tim.
So get ready, because you're about to have Stamps for Life after that.
I am. I really am. So what is your favorite Stephen Sondheim song, since you mentioned Into the Woods so artfully?
Oh, my favorite. God, there's so many. I really love Our Time.
Oh, my God, me too.
Fairly Roll Along. It really makes me so weepy because it's so hopeful, and it comes at that moment in the show when you actually know that there's that great line in The Hours where I'll reference the movie version, where Meryl Streep says to Claire Danes, not sure if you've ever heard of her, but where Meryl Streep says to Claire Danes, "I remember when I was your age and I thought that this was the beginning of happiness, and now I just know that it was happiness," which just sort of tears my heart out. And I think Our Time from Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll and George Firth, I believe, it's just so touching because it's these kids, these high schoolers or college-aged kids who just look to the future and say, this is it. We're about to grab it by, you know, the guts. And you know that so many terrible things await them. And I think that's sort of the challenge of being a person and being an artist, if I may, which is just knowing that, you know, life is for the taking, even though there's going to be a lot of stuff that lets you down and gets you down.
You know, I have two things to say about that, about your choice. First of all, you couldn't make a better choice.
Aww.
Well, I have three things to say. Second of all, when we were doing the pilot of 30-something, which most people who know me know that I was very involved with.
Sure.
We almost used Our Time as our theme music. I brought it in. Everybody liked it.
Yeah.
Everybody liked it. We weren't going to use the music. We were going to use the music, which I think is very effective and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was too expensive.
Mm, Steve.
And interestingly, because Merrily We Roll Along, which was a well-known, you know, Sondheim failure, although I saw the original production of it. Had opened just a few years before, but you know, Sondheim's catalog is valuable, and you know, and
yeah,
we could hardly, you know, blame him. But our theme music, if you listen to it and if you know Our Time, has a strong Our Time influence in it. We were all very moved by it, and we were all sad we couldn't use it.
What a great like E behind the, you know, true story, Hollywood story.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think it's true. It was a long time ago.
Exactly.
And then his favorite song, although this was, maybe he still says this, is Someone in a Tree from Pacific Overtures.
Oh, yes.
And I just recently came across on YouTube, for all musical theater lovers out there, a half-hour program that was done on CBS right when that was opening in the 70s. Where a very, very young Frank Rich interviews Sondheim in his home about the writing of that song, and it is performed in Sondheim, which is one of the things he does so brilliantly, is he breaks down the creation of that song and the needs of the story that led to it. And
I can't wait to go look that up. I love that.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. It's just, I think it was called Camera 3, Someone in a Tree. Just put Frank Rich, Sondheim, Someone in a Tree, and you will find it. So, okay, well, those are helpful answers. And now let me ask you this. This is my hard-hitting, you know, since Barbara Walters is retiring, I have to have her hectoring,
make
you know,
cry,
accusatory tone here. Is it a coincidence that you come from the same town, Upper St. Clair, as Stephen Chbosky, which is, I presume, how you pronounce his name.
I think so.
Sometimes there's a silent, you know, letter in there. So maybe it's Chbosky. I have no idea. But let's say Chbosky, who is both author of the novel The Perks of Being a Wallflower and also the director and screenwriter of the recent film.
That's right. Yeah,
and so
I
it's
think
no
it coincidence.
Is
coincidence. I think
it is or it isn't?
No, I think it is. Or I think it's, you know, I think it is a coincidence because he's a real native and I, you know, it's my adopted hometown. But I remember finding that out years later that this, you know, and he has a sister named Stacy Chbosky who had written a children's book called Who Owns the Sun about slavery. And she wrote it when she was in school and it was really a beautiful book. So they've got this super talented family. But yeah, I mean, I pl- please. I'll hitch my star to The Perks of Being a Wallflower, also a Simon & Schuster book.
Super popular. When you look on Goodreads or on Amazon, I mean, you see the books that have the most ratings and the most reader responses. And that's, in terms of the younger readership crowd, he is right up at the top, along with John Green, author of The Fault in Our Stars and interesting books like that. So have you ever met Stephen Chbosky?
I never have. He's like a legend to me. I'd love to meet him, but I have not.
Well, he's out here in L.A., and he works in TV, and I've never met him, but I'd like to meet him. I think I could maybe, I know you're coming out here for the Los Angeles Book Fest, and that might be something you could do when you're here.
That'd be fun, yeah.
Do you know Liza Minnelli? I'm much more interested in her. Do you know Liza?
I don't know Liza. This is where you learn I know nobody. I'm just this anonymous, strange... No, I only know her as a legend, which I think is maybe safer, because I feel like if I met her, I might marry her or something, because I think that's what happens.
It might be safer. I here's another YouTube reference, which is I am writing something.
Okay, go ahead. I thought you were going to say the Home Shopping Network thing she did.
No. I am writing a script that I will say is based on my book, because my book is going to become a TV series, and I can't be more specific about it until the next week or so. But there's a fabulous, fabulous song that called I Happen to Like New York. Do you know that song?
I love that song. I happen to like New York. Yeah.
Which is Cole Porter. It was famously sung by Bobby Short at the Cafe Carlyle, but also famously sung by Liza Minnelli's well-known mother, Judy Garland, and also sung, according to YouTube, by Liza Minnelli, who on YouTube there is a press preview for her concert, I think, at the Palace.
Mm-hmm.
And she's at the absolute height of her stardom.
Mm-hmm.
So she doesn't seem insane. She doesn't, slur her words. She doesn't laugh inappropriately. She looks gorgeous. And she sings that song, and you get goosebumps, and you are reminded why Liza Minnelli, pardon me sounding so gay here, but I don't care, is and was a great, great star.
Truly. No, there are some early, it's true. I mean, there are moments along the way. I mean, Liza with a Z, not to just totally turn this into a big stereotype, but that original concert is just nuts. It is so, it's like a lightning bolt. She's unputdownable if she were a book. It's
exactly.
Like
she's unputdownable. Absolutely.
You can't turn away.
And she is like a whole season that you have to watch in one sitting.
It's exactly right. She is, yes, and she's hilarious. She's very funny on Arrested Development, which I'm finally getting around to sort of mainlining.
She's very funny on that. But please, people, check out Liza Minnelli. This is the time of Liza with a Z, so she was winning Oscars and Tonys and Emmys and everything, and she's just a force of nature.
She couldn't go to the drugstore without getting an award.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Stephen Chbosky now that we've dealt with Liza. And I was thinking, I have, of course, read Perks of Being a Wallflower. When I sold my book, somebody said to me, have you ever read Perks of Being a Wallflower? And I hadn't, and I read it and I loved it. And and so I'm able to, to call upon it. I've also, of course, read your book. And you have both, the books share an element, was that they both have what we would describe as budding gay teen boys as protagonists. And so they're boys. I think I can probably say it well, is that they're almost gay, but not quite.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving towards it, and one hopes that they will arrive at it. But that's another thing that's very interesting, is that they see it on the horizon, but they're not quite there yet. And that gives it this wonderful sort of process of becoming quality.
Thank you.
And
Stephen,
it's so interesting, and there are moments in Better Nate Than Ever where that is dramatized, and they're very subtle, and you don't harp on them, and yet they really give several extra layers to what's going on with the book and with this character. And Perks of Being a Wallflower is totally considered a modern classic, and I really feel that, you know, that your book could become one too, because it's a book that I think there's. Nates are eternal. They will never stop being born, and they will never stop being formed by the world. And they are going to need this book, and this book is going to be useful to them.
Thank you.
And helpful.
Well, it's funny, because I've heard from so many grown-up Nates. I mean, I get, like, so many emails every week from like gay guys over 30 who say, I bought this book for my, you know, niece or nephew, and then I found myself reading it, and thank you. So it's been really cool just to hear from that sort of demographic too, because as you know, having worked on these sort of landmark television shows, the best kind of stuff you hope crosses over and reaches, you know, a readership or a viewership that isn't so narrowly defined. So that's been really gratifying, and I so appreciate your comments, Richard.
You wrote a piece for the Huffington Post that you know, put the question about, you know, where are the teen literature protagonists that just happen to be gay? And I just want to read a little brief passage from that because I found it very striking. This is Tim Federle speaking. He says, when I set out to write my first book for teenagers, I wanted to show another side of growing up gay, where you're less tortured about the world than you are just generally curious about it. I mean, I'm going to, you know, carve that in stone in my wall. Am I ever going to make it through algebra? Will my parents stay together? Does anyone else notice how adorable the substitute teacher looks in those chinos? These are also the trials and tribulations of gay teens, all teens for that matter. And I just think that that says it so clearly and so perfectly, and I think that it's something that you managed to capture in this book, which is to say that he just happens to be gay doesn't quite do it justice, but this is somebody who is dealing with all adolescence at once.
Yeah, as you know, as we all are. It's like, and I find
continually
totally. In adulthood, it's like just when everything is set up the way you want it, all of a sudden it's like, what do you mean they're putting up scaffolding outside my window? You know, it's life is just always coming at you at 100 miles per hour. So it's, yeah, and I think being a kid, you're just all you know, so much less equipped for that in a way. So you're also more equipped for it because you're less jaded.
Yes. Now, let's talk about show business.
We've
laid the groundwork for it. But one thing that sets you off from most writers, and you know, is your successful and thriving and continuing career as a performer on Broadway and as a choreographer as well. But before, I just wanted to say this. I spent a lot of time on YouTube, you know, just sort of getting ready for this, and because I love YouTube. And I wanted to explain what – and once you start watching YouTube, it leads you down 75,000 rabbit holes, all of which you're happy to be tumbling down.
Yeah.
I just want to explain what Broadway Backwards is. It's a benefit that's held every year in New York in which a Broadway performer sings a song they would never get to sing, which is a song written for the opposite sex. And I wanted to ask Tim Federle, my guest, you may even have done one of these, but what would your Broadway Backwards number be?
I never have, actually. I think, well, the honest answer is that when I was 12, as a little boy, I auditioned for a production of Oliver by singing As Long As He Needs Me. I sang, like, Nancy's 11 o'clock number. So I don't know, maybe I'd resurrect that one.
That'd be kind of perfect. That'd be kind of perfect. What is your second favorite Sondheim song? Do you have one?
My second favorite? Oh, my gosh. I love Into the Woods so much. And you know, Sunday in the Park, maybe finishing the hat.
Oh my God!
Yeah, so much. And I actually love Betty Buckley's cover that she does at the London concert. Is really triumphant. That's a great.
Oh, I haven't heard that.
Yeah, link it on the page.
I'm going to do that. Her brother, Norman Buckley, is a friend of mine, and he is a source of wonderful stories about her, all of which are very loving and positive.
Oh, I like that.
And she's Betty Lynn, and her mother is Betty Bob Buckley, and she's still alive.
Love it. Gosh.
And I mean this as no disrespect towards the person I'm going to mention, because she's very talented and very good, but I recently saw the revival of The Mystery of Edwin Drood in New York, which was, you know, successful and well done and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And Stephanie J. Block, who works all the time, who is got a wonderful voice, who's a great presence,
yeah,
who I saw do the first reading of Wicked with Kristen Chenoweth before they were even, you know, in rehearsal.
You do go back, yeah.
I do. And she was astonishing. And I'll never forget Kristen Chenoweth sitting next to her with tears coming down, rolling down her face as Stephanie Block sang Defying Gravity. And, you know, hearing that for the first time anywhere was quite thrilling. And however, seeing Stephanie J. Block in the role that Betty Buckley created in The Mystery of Edwin Drood was quite interesting, because I went again to YouTube, and they have a performance of Betty Buckley singing her stuff from Edwin Drood.
Oh.
And I said to Norman, it's not a fair comparison, because Stephanie Block is very good. But the difference between a great star, like your sister, and someone who's really good is all the difference in the world.
And Rupert Holmes, that music. I mean, that Perfect Strangers song is so
it's beautiful.
And we don't mean, you know, Balky the Tough Bacopolis. It's like perfect. It's a totally different song. It's, that is an incredible score. I love that score. Love that score.
Have you heard Barbara Streisand's recording of Moonfall?
No.
Get on YouTube. It was never released.
Yeah, well, I'm busy. I'm busy on this interview.
Yeah, it was never released, and it's pretty fantastic. She did it, I think, in 19, you know, shortly after the show opened. And so she's at the height of her Streisand-ness.
I love that whole era when she would see a show and she'd just go, I want to sing that song. You know, like she sang like Music of the Night from Phantom. Like she was the original Broadway backwards, just all roles she'd never get cast in, but she's Streisand, so she can do whatever she wants.
And she killed every one of them. I mean, just she hit them, you know, I think this is a baseball metaphor. She hit every one of them out of the park. I'm not sure if that's
out of
a football metaphor.
Out of the park, that's it, baby. You did it, kid.
So looking at your resume, you are also a choreographer. You might want to say a thing or two about that. And I see that you choreographed tributes to Angela Lansbury and Stephen Schwartz. And I have stories about both of them. I know them both, but I'm not going to tell them because this is your hour, and we should probably wrap in about 10 minutes. And let's jump ahead to your resident associate choreographer status on Billy Elliot, which sounds to me like an incredible experience that went on for years, that a lot of Billies came and went. And tell us a little bit about that. That must have been something wild.
It was. I mean, if for your listeners who didn't get to see Billy Elliot on stage, it was, of course, based on the movie directed by Stephen Daldry and choreographed by Peter Darling. And it's this fantastic story of this British boy whose dad wants him to be a boxer and Billy wants to be a ballet dancer. So I was brought on, I was in my late 20s, this was several years ago, and I was brought on to work with the boys, specifically the little boys who were tap dancing, for that sort of sequence in the show. There's so many different specialties in the show that we had, you know, acrobatic teachers and ballet coaches and voice coaches, and so I did tap stuff. And, you know, that was a real turnaround for me, because working with these kids was so inspiring, a little bit like what we were talking about earlier. They were so unjaded, and they were so excited just to be performing again. And it reminded me of when I was kind of living to dance as opposed to dancing to live. You know, it wasn't a job, it was a passion. And I really was reminded of that working with these kids. And so, yeah, it was a lot of 10-hour rehearsal days in these studios in New York. And it was very arduous but exciting to watch these kids go from, you know, Bambi to, like, a Broadway star. And that actually inspired me to write Better Nate Than Ever. It really, it, you know, inspired me to get off my butt and start writing.
Are you still auditioning for shows, Tim?
I'm not, actually. It's been a couple of years since I've auditioned for anything. I've been lucky enough to stay busy writing.
Do you want to go back? And, you know, I mean, you're so young. I mean, do you still have the – do you have – I don't want to say still. Do you have the performing bug?
I think I have the storytelling bug, and sometimes that comes out in performing, and sometimes that comes out in the sense that I'd like to write screenplays and I would love to write for TV. And so I think you are as good of an example as anybody, Richard, that, you know, life takes you on different paths or you take it on different paths, and I'm just trying to kind of stay open, which is like a big, you know, bullshit answer for...
Yes, it is, but it's still good.
Yeah, I don't really miss 8 shows a week. I miss that right now. But I could imagine a time in my life when it would just be so fun. One of the things you really miss, strangely enough, is you don't miss the onstage performing all that much, because for me at least, in the type of shows I did, after a couple performances, it's just the same show over and over and over again. But what you miss is like how fun it is in the dressing room, just kind of laughing with the other guys.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's a life that I have always envied, and it's a life that I have not had. And the main character of my book is somebody who lived that life.
Yeah, George, right?
Yeah, you know, so you're like such an ideal guest for me, because you're a young version of George, but George didn't have your writing ability. He's happy where he is, but I just envied that life of, you know, of not going to college, of coming to New York and starting to work right away. It's based on a couple of friends of mine, but it's also based on my own fantasies. And you have other books coming up, Tim. Do you want to tell us about them? You have quite a full roster.
I do, and then I just got the one. I have to get off the phone in a second. I think I'm going to get kicked out of this space. This is so
well. This is
like
perfect
gorilla
timing, because we're
this
wrapping
is,
up.
It's guerrilla theater. I have a cocktail recipe book called Tequila Mockingbird: Cocktails with a Literary Twist. That is coming out in a couple of weeks in April 2013 from Running Press Book Publishers. And that is like what it sounds like. It's ridiculous cocktails that are kind of mixed with classic works of literature thematically. And then I have a sequel to Better Nate Than Ever called 5-6-7 Nate that comes out next January. And I'm working with Simon & Schuster on a brand new 3-book series that I just finalized with them. So details of that will be forthcoming.
Fantastic. I think I should let you go before you are, you know, tossed out into the street.
Yeah, you don't want to hear the screaming, and your poor dogs need to be walked.
They do, yes. But I just wanted to, you know, first of all, everybody, thank you for checking, you know, this show out again. My guest has been Tim Federle. That's Federle, author of the brand new novel Better Nate Than Ever, which gets 5 Frank Riches, 5 Ben Brantleys, 5 Richard Kramers, and 5 Idina Menzels, and that's like more awards than Angela Lansbury has won in her lifetime. And, Tim, thank you so much for being here today. It's been a complete pleasure.
Thank you for having me on Richard Kramer, : These Things Happen.
Well, you know, you can even leave out the colon, but you have brought, you know, just run to the bookstore and get it, and, you know, and get the real book. You know, Kindles, you want to hold this book in your hands, and you want to give it to friends, and that's something that you can't do with a Kindle.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to read it and to meet you by phone. Okay,
yeah,
Tim, so this is Richard. Oh, fantastic. This is Richard Kramer, that hoping you will tune in next week when my guest, if we're lucky, because she's in the middle of rehearsing a play, will be Winnie Holtzman, who has two amazing credits, one of which she created My So-Called Life, on which I worked with her. And she then went on to write the book for Wicked, which some people have heard of. And she's also
a little black box musical.
A little black box musical that will probably never go anywhere. And thanks for joining me. And remember, when you least expect it, these things happen. Thank you.